brothers. Siblings are an interesting relationship. At one moment, they can be closest friends. At the next, the most strident foes. We will fight and vilely insult one another, but let one slight from outside the family arise against us, and we will take offense and possibly arms to defend our brothers. It takes a lot to break the bonds of brotherhood. I spend a lot of time with my brothers, and I was with my brother Nathan this week, and it reminded me of the last time I was with him, and we were putting down flooring. It can be it's a very interesting activity to have to work at manual labor with your brother, because sometimes in the midst of the fact that you've hammered your thumb three occasions while you're putting in flooring, as you take out the misery that is in your thumb onto your brother. It's a very unfair thing to do, but you do it anyway because your thumb is killing you. And it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of strength to break that bond of brotherhood. Even though he may yell at me, I may yell at him, we're still brothers, and we still live together and operate together and love one another. But for Joseph and his brothers, it has been 20 years of a broken, fractured relationship. Years and miles have continually separated Joseph from the rest of his family. And now the restoration of the family is beginning to take place. Judah has just declared the new mindset, the new heart that is in the brothers. Joseph has been waiting for this statement, this declaration, this evidence that the brothers have a new way of thinking and acting within the family. No longer are they willing to sell the favorite of their father, regardless of their father's desire. No, regardless of the fact that what they do will break their father's heart. Now, they will willingly become slaves to prevent their father's sorrow. And now Joseph must respond. But how will he manage to take this bifurcated family and heal the breach? As Joseph carefully navigates this troublesome reintegration of the family, we see the emphasis on the hand of providence, the voice of prophecy, and the word of peace. The hand of providence, the voice of prophecy, and the word of peace. The first challenge that meets Joseph is the immediate relationship, the immediate issue of his relationship with those who sold him into slavery. How will he relate to these brothers who captured him, threw him into a pit, and sold him to a wandering nomadic tribe of traders? While he no longer has any reason to fear him, he is their boss. He is the head of Egypt. They can't do anything to him any longer. They have every reason, though, to mistrust Joseph. They have every reason to think that Joseph, at this acme of power as head of Egypt, has every reason to hold a grudge and wreak revenge upon them. And so Joseph does not skirt the issue, but deals with it head on. The old concern of their treachery is modified by Joseph's new concept of God's providence. The speech of Judah has melted the heart of Joseph, and the time has come for him to reveal himself. As verses 1 through 3, we read, he cannot hold himself back. He tells all of his servants to leave. Get out. And he wants no one to see him as he makes himself known to his brothers. He doesn't want anyone to know what their relationship was before. And after all those servants have gone out, he weeps. He weeps so loudly that even though the servants are out of the room, they still hear what's going on. They still hear him weeping. And apparently his house was kind of near Pharaoh's, because even Pharaoh's household hears the cry of Joseph. As it's not a weep of mourning or sorrow, it's a weep of joy. Because now he is weeping because his family is going to be put back together. There's a scene in verse 3, and Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph, doth my father yet live? Again and again and again I will repeat it, that this whole event, this whole Joseph's whole trying of his brothers has not been about him or his Benjamin, it's all about dad. Joseph's first question after he reveals himself to his brothers is my father still alive? This question he's already asked. He's asked them before when they first show up, is the old man that you spoke of, your father, is he still alive? And they have told him that he was. But now the question has a different tinge to it. He says, I am Joseph, I am your brother, is not that old man, not your father, but is my father still alive? This revelation comes as a complete and utter shock to his brothers. They cannot respond. His brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. They're scared. The king, the vizier of Egypt, the second in command, Pharaoh's right-hand man, has just revealed himself to be the brother they have sold into slavery. Imagine that. You've sold your brother into slavery, and all of a sudden he's the one who holds your life in his hand. The immediate thought is, what is he going to do? After all, you have just willingly stated that you will offer yourself up as his slave. Listen to his second opener, though. Verse 4, Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near. Joseph says, come here, come here. And they all gather up. What can they do? They can't run away. He's the second in command of Egypt. They have nowhere to run. They draw near and he says, I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. He doesn't sugarcoat. He doesn't candy coat. He tells them exactly who he is and what they did. I am Joseph. I am your brother. And you sold me like a piece of furniture to be a slave in Egypt. He does not excuse their behavior, but calls it what it is. And suddenly, Joseph adds a new concept to the activity. Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves as you sold me hither. He says, you sold me, but don't worry about it. Don't be terrified. Don't be scared that I'm going to wreak immediate and awful vengeance upon you. Why? What is it that allows Joseph to say, guys, it's done. Don't worry about it. Verse 5, for God did send me before you to preserve life. Guys, you sold me into Egypt. You did a horrible, horrible, reprehensible thing. But it was God's purpose. You sold me, but God sent me. God sent me before you to preserve your life. God put me here so that you would have a place of safety when the famine came. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall be neither earing nor harvest. This is only 2 years into the famine. There are still 5 years left of unremitting poverty. They may have known something about Egypt's providence, plenty. They may have heard of this guy who had prophesied a 7-year famine. But Joseph tells them why this has all come about, why it's necessary for them to move. God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Joseph said, guys, you sold me into slavery, but God had a purpose and a plan. He sent me here so that you would be saved. He sent me here because he knew that a famine would come. He sent me here to preserve your life and the life of all of those who are with you, your sons and your daughters. He had to be sold in order to do that. And so in verse 8, "So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me to be father of Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." Guys, you sold me into Egypt, but God sent me. It was not you that sent me here. It was God who sent me here. I had to be sold into slavery. I had to be sold to Pharaoh. I had to be betrayed by Potiphar. I had to be betrayed by Potiphar's wife. I had to be sent to prison. I had to be there in order to interpret the dream of the butler who would then tell Pharaoh about me so that I could interpret Pharaoh's dream and he would put me in charge of Egypt. And now in charge of Egypt, I am able to rescue the family that God has chosen. How can he conclude otherwise than to say, "It was not you that sent me hither, but God"? I love the story of Joseph and his brothers. And we're going to hear this theme reiterated again in chapter 50 in a very concise way, but we'll come to that later. Because in the story of Joseph, we have the reality of God's providence and what we call theodicy, which is, how do we deal with God's goodness in evil that exists in the world? How do we deal with God's sovereign providence and the reality of evil that occurs? Can we just say that there is no such thing as evil, that everything is good? No. Can we say that there is evil that God is not in control of? No. The story of Joseph reveals the reality of evil and God's sovereignty over it. Providence does not deny the reality of evil. What Joseph's brothers did was evil, sinful, reprehensible. But Joseph emphasizes that God is able to act, even ordain their reprehensible behavior in order to bring about good. God is able to use evil to bring about his purposes, to bless and keep and protect his people. Do you trust God's providence? It's easy to trust God's providence when everything's going well. It's easy to trust God's providence when things are going well. It's difficult to trust God's plan, his sovereign control, when evil occurs. Do you trust God's plan when people do evil against you? I hope that none of us ever experience what it is like to have your own family sell you into slavery. There's not much more that you could think of as being more reprehensible than that. But as a child of God, we are called to remember that even in the midst of such a terrible sin committed against us as that, God is working his purposes out. Do you trust God? Do you trust his providence to bring blessing and disaster? Nothing could be worse in our minds than a 7-year famine. Could you imagine 7 years where food is scarce in our country? It'd be hard to imagine something so devastating to our way of life. And yet if that happened, could we have faith in God's providence that he is using that for our good? Joseph is able to reintegrate his family because he emphasizes to his brothers the relationship most broken and within the family unit, that God's providence enables them to return to their family unity. The hand of providence, but also the voice of prophecy. The situation with the family still needs attention. Even though the brothers are reunited, their families aren't. Their brothers and their wives and their children and Jacob are still apart. Jacob remains in a famine-ridden land. The core concern of Joseph comes back to the foreground as he repeats 4 times to his brothers his concern about his father. Joseph uses his position and his Pharaoh to reassemble his family. Joseph gives instruction to his brother in verse 9, "Haste ye and go to my father and say unto him, Thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me and tarry not." He tells them, go back to dad and tell him to get down here. Don't wait. Don't loiter. Don't stay up there in that famine-ridden land. You've got 5 more years of famine. It's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse for the next 5 years. You need to get down here where I can take care of you. He has not only a plan, but a place of residence for his family. In verse 10, "And thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen." The land of Goshen is an interesting title or a name for a place that antiquity has lost. But we learn later that the place where the children of Israel resided was the land of Ramses. And so we know where it is. It's in the delta of the Nile. He plans to take care of his family. "Thou shalt be near unto me, thou and thy children and thy children's children and thy flocks and thy herds and all that thou hast, and there will I nourish thee, for there are yet 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all that thou hast come to poverty." Get down here. Bring your flocks, bring your herds, bring your children, bring your grandchildren. Get down here because I've got a place for you. I've got a place where you will be taken care of. Because if you stay where you are, bad things are going to happen. You're going to come to poverty. Your life will be threatened. You're going to lose all your cattle. In an agrarian economy, your wealth was measured by how much cattle, how many goats, what your size of your grain was. You're going to lose all of that. Staying in Canaan is not an option. You have to move. And how will Jacob take their news? Will Jacob believe their brothers? Put yourself in Jacob's position. Your 11 boys come back to you and say, "Hey, you know that brother of ours that you thought has been dead for over 20 years? Yeah, he's alive and he's second in command of Egypt." Your dad, Jacob, would probably say, "Guys, it's been a long journey, I know. You need to go get some rest, get out of the sun. It's a famine condition. You get a little heat stroke. You need to get some water in you because that's insane." Jacob said, "Behold, your eyes see in the eyes of my brother Benjamin that it is my mouth that speaketh to you, and ye shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste and bring my father hither." He says, when you go and see dad, you're going to tell him what your eyes have seen, what the eyes of Benjamin has seen, that this is no mirage, this is no mistake, that it is my mouth that talks to you. Look, here's Benjamin, here's me. You see the family resemblance? You're going to tell dad about what you have seen here, about my house and how big it is and how great I am and how much power I have, that is, I am able, not because I am such a great guy, but that I am able to take care of all of you guys. And you're going to get dad down here. There's a note of urgency in Joseph's statement to his brothers. This is not something that they can just, you know, lackadaisically go about, and when they got time, they'll do it. It is, get him down here now. Do it now. Hurry. This is something that must be done immediately. The longer you stay in Canaan, the worse it's going to get, and your property is being depleted even as we speak. He encouraged them to join Jacob. Joseph must trust his previously untrustworthy brothers to convince Jacob to come to Egypt. Think about it. The famine has 5 years to go, and now these brothers have to tell Jacob that we have to move to Egypt. And Jacob probably knew his family history. There were some bad things that went down in his family down in Egypt. And Joseph doesn't tell his brothers to confess the fact of what they did, their treachery, but merely to tell Jacob that Joseph is ruler over Egypt. Joseph never says, go and tell Jacob, You know that brother we convinced you was dead? Yeah, we sold him into slavery in Egypt. He never tells them to make that confession. He basically tells them, tell Dad I am king down here and that he needs to get down here. Having given them their instructions, Joseph spends some time reuniting with his brothers, and he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Moreover, he kissed all of his brethren and wept upon them, and after that, his brethren talked with him. There is nothing in this description that indicates Joseph has any ill feeling towards the brothers who have done him so much wrong. He begins with Benjamin, the one who had done no wrong to him at all, the one who shared a mother and the one to whom he was probably closest. They have a reunion, and then he goes to all the brothers and shares in that same activity of just rejoicing, tears of joy, that they have been reunited after over 20 years apart. The brothers finally begin to accept the truth and talk to Joseph. It's time for them to catch up. The party at Joseph's home does not go unnoticed in the court of Pharaoh, as we read in verse 16. The fame thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brethren are come, and it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants. Pharaoh hears the report. Hey, have you heard? Joseph's brothers are here. He's found them. Which is good for Pharaoh, because Joseph was practically a slave still. Pharaoh wasn't going to let him go. And so Joseph's brothers coming meant that he could use them as an emissary to reunite Joseph. Pharaoh probably knew that Joseph was not the only child in his family. And so this was a way that his favorite, the second in command in Egypt, could have his family together and make him more permanent in the land. The court thinks that if these guys are like Joseph, we need to have them here, the wisest man that Pharaoh knows. And Pharaoh operates. Pharaoh said to Joseph, say unto thy brothers, do this, lay your beasts and go and get you to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt. Ye shall eat the fat of the lamb. Joseph is given wagons and material to bring his family down. The brothers, their wives, their little ones, their father. And also he says in verse 20, regard not your stuff, for the good of all the land of Egypt is yours. Pharaoh says, all that stuff that you have in Canaan, forget about it. Just leave it and come down, because everything in Egypt is yours. If you must, leave those possessions. Because all the wealth, all the good of the land of Egypt is yours. Now you might not think that that's a statement that is worthy of much note, but remember to whom this is being read, to whom this is being written. A nation in a wilderness, a nation who has just come out of Egypt, a nation who has just taken a whole bunch of stuff from a whole bunch of Egyptians as they left in the Exodus. Joseph and Pharaoh make plans to bring Jacob to Egypt. This is a fulfillment of that prophecy of the dream. We told about the two dreams of Joseph, the one of the wheat sheaves and the one of the sun and the moon and the stars. The wheat sheaf dream has come to pass as all of his brothers have bowed before him, but this dream of the entire family being united before Joseph has yet to come to pass. And here Joseph and Pharaoh are making plans to bring that dream to fulfillment. For providence does not occur merely in the abstract, but it uses human efforts. There's a false little ditty that goes, God has no hands but your hands. That's silly. Number one, that God is a spirit and has no hands at all. But secondly, God is able to work above and beyond human activity, but he also most uses his creation. Joseph and Pharaoh are not intending to fulfill dreams. They're not sitting down and Joseph is saying, Pharaoh, but I had this dream once over 20 years ago about the sun, moon, 11 stars. They're not doing all of this. They're not saying, I have to, by the strength of my ability, bring God's purposes and plans into effect. They're simply doing what they must in the situation. They're doing what God calls them to do. They are obeying the word of God. They're doing what God in his law requires. Joseph is taking care of his family. That is his primary concern, not the fulfillment of some promise. Some attempt to force God's will, and those who do repeatedly fail, for even David would not kill Saul to make himself king. And so the path to the fulfillment of God's promises is the path of obedience. We are not called to be those who take upon ourselves the responsibility to build God's kingdom. And some in the church have done, and that has spawned the Crusades and coerced baptisms and a lot of other forcible conversion techniques. We are called to be those who proclaim the word, to be faithful in that, and to let God be the one who brings his promises and grows his church. We are to be those who obey, to obey the law of God, and thus, in the obedience to God, to see the voice of prophecy come to pass. The hand of promise, the voice of prophecy, but finally the word of peace. The chapter closes with Joseph sending his brothers to Jacob and Jacob's eventual resolve to visit Egypt. And two things stand out in this section that echo the peace that occurs to God's people. Joseph sends his brothers back to his father's house with gifts. Verse 21, the children of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the commandment of Pharaoh and gave them provisions for the way. To all of them he gave each man changes of raiment, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of raiment. Joseph gives his brothers gifts. Changes of raiment were kind of expensive, and he gives each of them some, but Benjamin gets more. The brothers have demonstrated they're okay with this favoritism, and there's no reason for Joseph not to demonstrate special kindness to this brother who shares his mother. He points Benjamin out as being close to him, and he gives his father this wondrous gift. All the good things of Egypt are put upon 10 donkeys. In others, he gives corn and bread and provisions, the stuff that he needs in the way. But he sends them off with a interesting command. Verse 24, so he sent his brethren away and they departed, and he said unto them, see that ye fall out not by the way. I read that and I thought to myself, that's curious. What does he mean by that? The word there is differently translated. Somewhere it says, do not quarrel on the way. And that's what it means here. We say that two people have fallen out when they have quarreled, and he said, don't do that on the way. And the question is, why? Why would the brothers quarrel on the way? Is Joseph worried that they will quarrel about Benjamin? If so, would he have ever let Benjamin go back? Or would he have sent a cohort or troops with them to keep them from doing so? What would they have to quarrel about? What would they have to argue about? They've just been reunited. The brothers have just heard that their deception to Jacob has been found out. Benjamin, a person who has not been a part of their original plot, has heard the story or has found out the story. At least he knows that his brothers sold Joseph into slavery to Egypt. That was news to Benjamin. What would he tell Dad when he got back? They faced the truth coming out to Jacob. Joseph has spent some time encouraging not to dwell upon their evil deed. Joseph has said, it's okay, we're fine. I'm not going to wreak havoc upon your lives. I've seen God's providence at work, and I want you to see it as well. And so the most likely explanation of this command is to prevent them from entering into the blame game on the way back. Reuben, looking at Simeon, and said, you were a stupid face for saying that we should have thrown him into the pit and sell him or kill him, and arguing about who was chiefly responsible for the evil that was done to Joseph. Who was to blame for the treachery against him? Joseph says, look, that doesn't matter. Don't argue about that because it's irrelevant. Yes, you did evil. Confess, forsake, I forgive you because God intended this to occur so that we would all be brought to peace and life. Jacob receives his sons with peace, but he doesn't believe their story. And they went up out of the land of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. Isn't that interesting? Jacob, his heart is failing. His heart faints because he hears such a ridiculous tale. He says, that's stupid. There's no way that can be true. How could such a marvelous event, a son I haven't seen in over 20 years, really be alive? It's impossible. But the brothers redouble their effort, verse 27, and they told him all the words of Joseph which he had said to them. And when he had saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. They say to him, look, this is what Joseph said to us. We saw him. We saw him and talked to him. We saw him in his greatness, in his house, which is great. Look at the carts. Look at all the wagons. Look at what he sent you. See, all of these donkeys with all of these great, marvelous things to Egypt. We didn't buy them. See, we still have all of our money. Joseph, there's no way that we could have gotten all of this stuff, but that Joseph had given them to us. How could their story not be true with such evidence? And Jacob begins to believe. Notice the difference in naming between verse 27 and verse 28. In verse 27, it's Jacob, whose heart had previously fainted. Jacob, the supplanter. Jacob, the deceiver. Jacob, the schemer. Jacob, the unbeliever. In 27, his heart's beginning to revive. And in chapter 28, it's now Israel. And Israel says, enough. Stop. Can you imagine what would have encouraged him to say such a thing? All of the brothers, Benjamin, Reuben, Levi, Simeon, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Naphtali, all of them are just piling on. Dad, you got to believe us. We got to go. We got to go. We got to go. The wagons are here. We need to go to Egypt. We need to take all of our stuff down there. Let's go. He hasn't believed them. He said they're nuts and finally says, stop. Enough. I get it. Joseph, my son, is alive. I will go and see him before I die. The weak eyes that have been failing will once again see that beloved son he hasn't seen in over 20 years. And the faithless man who said before that his eyes would go down weeping into the grave if Benjamin did not come back, and would say said that earlier when Joseph was lost to him, now say that his eyes will not go to the grave until he sees his beloved son once again. My friend, your eyes need to see a sight better than Joseph before you die. Your eyes need to see a salvation greater than the great deliverance that Joseph gave to his brothers. For how we prepare for death defines our lives, and our Savior is not Joseph, but Jesus. Our problem isn't a famine, it is sin. It is the wickedness and evil we do against God, for which He is rightly and justly wrathful against us. A sin that deserves death and hell forever. But Jesus took upon Himself our hell that we might receive life. Jesus went down, came down to earth to make salvation possible for us. But we, like Jacob, must become Israel. We must change from our unbelieving heart to believe what God says about what Jesus has done for us. To believe that in Jesus and in only Jesus is salvation offered to us. And to accept that as being our salvation. Is that true of you today? Beloved in Christ, we anticipate a better vision than that of a lost son. We anticipate a better vision than that of Joseph and Jacob. We anticipate the vision of a victorious son coming in the clouds to claim us for his own, to put right everything that has gone wrong in the earth. That is our blessed hope. That is what is our encouragement. That is what fuels us in our daily activity. It's what gives us hope. In this world where we have that vision of what Christ is going to do for us, do we believe the blessings that God sends upon us daily? The old ditty says, count your blessings, name them one by one, count your blessings, see what God has done. It's some activity that oftentimes we do not engage in because the detriments of sin are ever so clear to our eyes that we forget the blessings that God daily pours out upon us. For our eyes are often like Jacob's, unable to believe that Joseph has sent the carts to bring us to glory, unable to believe the good things that God has granted to us, wasting God's good gifts, expecting disaster. Oftentimes when God sends me gracious things, I think to myself, well, I'll enjoy this now, but the other shoe is just about to drop. How faithless, how unbelieving, when we should receive the blessings that God gives us with joy, with gratitude, and remembering His promise that whether for good or ill, everything He sends to us will bring about His glory and our good in time.